I would like to start with...
Is this a burping contest?
It's not a burping contest.
Okay.
I just, you know, we're trying to start the show with a little bit more like pointed conversation.
Yes.
As opposed to us just yammering. But like provide a, you know, something that we would like to talk about that wouldn't necessarily take up more than like 5-10 minutes.
Okay.
But in this case, it's Diet Coke versus Coke Zero.
Oh, okay. Okay. Okay.
What do you prefer? Are you a Diet Coke drinker?
I am, but I'm a zero person. But Pepsi.
Oh, okay.
Because I find the Zero Coke, the Coke Zero or whatever, I find it goes flat almost immediately.
Oh, I've never had that issue. I feel the same way about Coke Zero.
Okay.
But there is a different flavor profile to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the story as I know it, Diet Coke introduced in 1983. The story as I've been told it is that Diet Coke, the formula was tried to be matched for when they introduced New Coke, when they stopped being Coca-Cola.
Okay.
And they brought in that new flavor in the 80s that everybody hated,
yep,
rallied against, and it was quickly expunged, which brought about the return of what they call Coca-Cola Classic, which is still on the bottles and cans to this day, that little word classic. And that's why that's there.
Yes.
Is to reassure people that this is not New Coke, the hated formula. Mm-hmm. But apparently Diet Coke is meant to either precede that new Coke flavor or come after that Coke flavor. So it's meant to taste like that other formula.
Huh.
Versus Coke Zero, which was introduced in 2006, which is meant to more closely align with the Coca-Cola Classic flavor.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Whether there's any veracity to that, I cannot say. Coca-Cola's website itself says that both drinks are sugar-free and calorie-free. Coca-Cola Zero looks and tastes more like Coca-Cola Original, while Diet Coke has a different blend of flavors, which give it a lighter taste.
Hmm.
I don't know if that's true. For me, Diet Coke is more acidic.
Yes, absolutely.
And less sugary. I guess that would be the lighter flavor they're talking about.
Yes.
And I actually prefer that to a regular Coca-Cola flavor.
I find that like true Coke or even true Pepsi now, it's too much for me. Like I find it heavy. Like syrupy.
It's been ages since I've tried any.
Oh, like I had a mouthful. John got just like a regular Coke or Pepsi or whatever at a restaurant. And I had a mouthful and it was like a kick in the teeth.
Mm-hmm.
It was just so strong.
Hilariously, I think there's 56 grams of sugar in a regular February. Regular. Valentine's.
Valentine's.
What's that subreddit called? Bone apple tea.
Bone apple teats.
Bone apple teats. quick aside, personal pet peeve, people that call Lego, yeah, Legos.
Legos.
It does not need nest to be plural. It is a plural noun. Mm. Lego, or you can say Lego bricks if you really need to add a...
Didn't know that.
Anyhow, the plurality is Lego.
Hmm.
You wouldn't say dices, would you?
Die.
Well, dice is the plural.
No. Die is the plural. Isn't it?
Hold up. No.
Dice is the singular. Die is the plural.
No, other way. Die is the plural.
Other way?
Die is the singular. Dice is the plural. Do we... Jess?
I think you're right.
Jess, let us know. Pop in here.
No, he's right. He's right.
Give us a verdict. Okay, I guess you don't have to.
I love it because Jess is going to be like, you're both wrong. Yeah.
They're actually called cacti.
Something totally different. What would a group of dice be called?
Dice.
Like a murder of crows, but like a group of dice.
It's like mice. You don't say mices either.
No, but I want to have like a fun name. Like...
The singular of mice, though, is my.
No, but what would like a whole group of dice out on the Serengeti would be referred to as like a geek of dice?
Probably a roll.
Oh, that's good.
A roll of dice.
Good job, Ben. Good
job.
As
they tumble along the Serengeti.
In their natural habitat.
As like Attenborough's voiceover is just like, you might assume that the white and black pattern makes them too visible on the high desert. But actually, it's meant to mimic the light and shadow patterns.
I love it. That's
good. I can't do a David Attenborough voice, sir. Good enough?
I have two questions for you.
Please.
Question number one. How many Diet or Coke Zeros would you say you drank in a week?
a lot.
Yeah.
And there's a reason for this. And I'm not under any illusion that Diet Coke is healthy.
Yeah.
But I have committed to a lifestyle change, which means that I don't snack or eat anything after 8 o'clock, after dinner, I should say. So about 6, 6:30.
Yeah.
And sometimes in the evening to de-stress, I just need something.
Yeah.
So I have diet sodas.
I feel like it's better than like a wine or a beer.
It is less calories than a wine or beer, for whatever the fuck that's worth.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm trying very, very hard not to eat like sugar intentionally, just incidentally in certain foods. So that's why I got some Diet Cokes to help me get it through the evenings without gorging.
Perfect.
Yeah. So I drink like, I don't know, 3 a day maybe, depending.
Okay.
It's a little high, especially because up until, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago, I hadn't drank soda in like 5 years.
Wow.
Only like soda water.
So you went hard.
I was just like, fuck it. If I'm not going to have any fun in my mouth, well, that sounds weird, doesn't it? But I'm not going to, you know, I'm sticking with it. If I'm not going to have any fun in my mouth, food wise, I at least can have a diet soda. So now I've become something of a connoisseur. I search for the more unique diet sodas. We found a Coke Zero Cherry recently. And
that's what I've been drinking.
Yeah,
I love a cherry Coke or a cherry Pepsi.
It's a fun change. It's still a bit sweet for me.
Oh, I love it.
I can't recommend 7 Up Zero or whatever the shit they call it.
Yeah.
Does not taste nice. I've branched out into the occasional Diet Pepsi as well. Diet Root Beer, great. Tastes
love
the same.
Love Diet Root Beer. Yeah.
Diet Dr. Delicious. Pepper, fantastic. I just mean as far as like flavor profile, it does not shift from what the other soda tastes like.
Now, this leads me to my next question, actually quite perfectly.
Wonderful.
Do you think in the near future, there's the possibility of like, instead of wine tasting, like you go to the vineyard for the weekend, you go to the pop, like the dispensary, where you could go on like a diet soda tasting adventure.
Yeah.
I would love to stay in a nice hotel room that looks out over a beautiful vista and then do a tasting of different pops.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And it's funny you should bring this up, Lexi, because I've actually just closed on a chalet just outside of Banff.
Don't you tease me, because I would love that.
And we will be starting. We are actually growing our own diet sodas there. It's our own brand of diet soda.
The Canfields.
We're calling it Raples. Raples Diet.
No,
diet
that's
pop.
A terrible name.
I know. It's one of my favorite things is that a portmanteau of our last name is not good either.
No.
It's either Stankle or Raples.
Stankle Fields.
So we prefer to refer to ourselves as the Staples Rankles family.
Strankles. Strankles.
Strankle. Nah, it doesn't work either.
Just let the kids pick their own last name.
They more or less have. Right now, that's why one of them refers to himself as his first name, and then Staples Rankles. He's pluralized our last name, which everybody knows that's, our last name. That is plural already, the singular of which is just Rye. No? Okay.
No. It's good.
Just crickets.
Did somebody say crickets?
Let's go to our theme song. Welcome back to the show. This is Dork Matters, a dorky podcast for dorks, and I'm your dork dad host, Ben Renkel. And with me every single time is our Edorkator, Lexi Hunt.
You.
What up, Lex?
I like that that's become my theme song. It's just like laser sounds from a rave.
Yeah. Have you ever gone to a rave?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah, I used to be.
How old were you?
I was in my late teens, early 20s, art school times. You know, I like to dance.
How come nobody invited me to a rave in art school?
I think you weren't in school at that time there, Benji.
Oh, no. Shit. I went to one rave in high school, grade 12.
Was this like a field, like what type of rave was it?
It was at the Max Bell Arena, all ages sort of thing.
Fancy.
I don't know who was playing.
Doesn't matter.
Lots of people with big white gloves and, you know, those weird 90s soothers in their mouths and Somebody gave me half a tab of E to drop and then got a back rub from someone.
Ugh, no.
And then felt like I was sinking through the floor. It was a fine time, whatever.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. But we're not here to talk about raves unless you want to rave about our topic tonight.
Which is what?
We're talking Wes Anderson.
I love the possibility of all the plinky music and cool sound effects, because I know that, like, Jess is an absolute master. Like, she's a lyrical...
When she goes...
Soundsmith. Yeah. She goes hard. She and goes so hard. I'm really excited to see what she's going to do, because Wes Anderson movies, documentaries...
They're not documentaries.
They're not real? Oh.
No.
They're mockumentaries, but yeah. It really has a distinctive sound.
What if Wes Anderson did, like, that dog show one or whatever it's called?
Oh, Best in Show?
Best in
that
Show.
That would have been great. They should remake that, done by Wes Anderson.
The rock one.
A Mighty Wind.
A Mighty Wind.
That's a great one.
Wait,
too.
Isn't that the sequel? What's the other one called?
No, because Best in Show is about the dogs. A Mighty Wind is about the folk music festival.
Right, isn't there another one about, like, rock music people?
Oh, Spinal Tap.
Spinal Tap,
yeah.
Thank you. There oh, my
go.
Brain.
You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is, if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
So full of holes.
Yeah. That's...
From all the diet soda I'm drinking.
All the diet soda. Aspartame just eating
is
your
eating
brain.
My brain apart. Nobody link me to fucking studies about how it actually is doing that, please.
Yeah, we don't need to know. It just, I mean.
I have very few pleasures / vices left in my life. Don't take this from me. Don't. What am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
Go to drinking for real?
No, for gosh sakes.
Yeah.
God.
For gosh sake.
Gosh darn it, Ben.
Dang it. Wes Anderson. Wes Anderson has some of the best soundtracks, I would say, for every single film.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's just fucking roll. Let's go.
Yeah.
Let's roll through this discography. Let's talk about it. Well, let's just do it movie by movie.
Mm-hmm.
1996, Bottle Rocket. The Wilson brothers and somebody else who I can't remember try to do a robbery of some sort, and they're idiots. And that's about the synopsis you need for that one.
Someone I don't remember. If that isn't just like
the
tagline for Dork Matters, there's a guy, I don't remember his name.
Yeah, we could figure this out pretty easily, couldn't we?
Okay, so you have all three of the Wilson brothers in this movie. You have
all three. There's three?
Oh, There's three Wilson brothers.
Who the fuck is the third Wilson brother?
Andrew.
I've never heard of Andrew Wilson.
Andrew Wilson is in Idiocracy.
Could you imagine being the third Wilson brother?
Yeah, I think it'd be awesome, because you'd kind of get like...
Or the third Hemsworth.
A little bit of the joy without having to actually
I think it'd be great.
I think it'd be awesome. Yes,
okay.
I want the fortune without the fame.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because if I had like two siblings that were very close, like, they're going to buy you a car. Right?
I guess, yeah, that's
like,
true.
They're going to be like, here's a car. You're like, I'm Owen Wilson. Here you go. But no, the third one.
The third man I'm trying to talk about is Robert Musgrave.
Oh, yeah. Robert Musgraves.
Who does not have a Wikipedia entry.
Which is interesting. But also James Caan was in that movie as well.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. And Lumi Cavazos.
Did you like that movie?
I remember thinking it was okay. It's like the least Wes Anderson-y of the Wes Anderson films.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember finding it interesting, I guess.
I found it very, like, depressing.
Yeah. Do we do a full rundown of the plot? I don't know if that's necessary.
I mean, we could. I mean, Bottle Rocket.
Yeah, they try to rob a place. It doesn't go great. Stuff happens. They have to get away.
Yeah, but it also kind of sets the tone for a lot of the themes that you see throughout the rest of the Wes Anderson, like, empire of movies. Anderson. Like, he really likes hotels.
Webb's Andersons. Yeah.
Webb's Anderson. He loves a hotel, or a motel, I should say, as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always about, like, a journey in some capacity.
Yeah. It was a limited release. It wasn't a commercial success. Acclaimed from critics, It's when I went back to watch after I got into Wes Anderson films, having not seen it first. My first experience we will get to in 2001.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a $7 million movie. Its box office was $560,000, so not a financial success. Critical success, though, 85% overall on old RT, Roddy Tobbs, as we call it. It's a good name for like a D&D game. Roddy Tom's.
It is. Roddy Tom's.
Do we have anything else to say about Bottle Rocket?
No.
The Forgotten Stepchild. Did you watch Succession?
No.
Okay, never mind. I can't make a reference to the oldest half-brother of the other siblings who is kind of just a joke slash forgotten. Let's move on. We have Rushmore.
Yeah.
In 1998. This is where it 98. Starts. Yeah.
This is where it starts for us. And it's the beginning of a certain Jason Schwartzman's acting career.
This is where he takes off.
Yep.
Yeah, this movie. What do we got to say about Rushmore?
It's like an interesting combination of like Harold and Maude. So the whole premise is Jason Schwartzman's character plays this like prep school dork.
Yeah, 15-year-old loser.
He's not smart. He's not dumb. He's not liked.
He has a lot of like fake accomplishments like non-accomplishments. Like he starts a lot of clubs and hangs his literal beret on those. Yeah.
And he's the only member, him and his like two friends.
Yeah, and he like builds this unlikely sort of friendship with this old dude who's played by Bill Murray.
Mm-hmm.
And then their friendship is tested as they both become smitten with, I guess, the high school teacher of Jason Schwartzman.
She's not a high school teacher. She's one of the elementary school teachers of the prep school.
Oh, okay. She doesn't teach the high school group.
She doesn't teach him.
Gotcha.
But she's a teacher at the school that he attends, I believe. And so it's this weird, like a 15-year-old making a play for an adult woman. Mm-hmm. It's like, there's something unsettling about the whole thing too, but it's, I don't know, like it's so weird that it works.
Yeah, the sort of play within a play is very interesting and sort of compelling. It's about Vietnam and
yeah.
a 15-year-old American boy's perspective on it. And it's weird. And
the play that he writes.
It's you know, it's very Wes Anderson-y before that even became a verb, you know, like my memory is foggier on this, and yet also very clear in certain parts.
It's not as poised as the other ones, like...
Or manicured.
Yeah, like the rest of the Wes Anderson filmography, the characters are kind of posing in like a tableau before they begin, or...
Right, they definitely become much more like storybook, like we're reading a picture book.
Yeah.
And they get more and more that way as we go along.
Yeah.
Which is one of the things that I find very appealing about it as a visual artist.
This one, it really is like, it's so interesting because you can see his progression so beautifully in things like Rushmore versus The French Dispatch. And you can see like, yeah, I see that it's the same director, but it's really this person has evolved over time and really like perfected their style.
And changed and made decisions about what is very important to them versus not. Fun fact about Rushmore, Alexis Bledel plays an extra as a Grover Cleveland High School student.
That's really interesting. Andrew Wilson's in this one too.
Oh, wow. There you go.
He's a real person, Ben.
Yeah, no, I can see his Wikipedia page, which is more than we can say for What's-His-Face.
I would like to say that one of my most favorite jokes of all time comes from this movie.
And what is that joke?
When they're all having dinner together and Owen Wilson's character as an OR doctor shows up and Jason Schwartzman's character makes a joke, like makes a comment about how rude it is for him to show up not dressed for dinner.
I like your nurse's uniform, guy.
It's Luke Wilson, isn't it?
Is it Luke Wilson? Yeah, it's Luke Wilson.
It's okay. I mean, they're interchangeable to me, too.
Yeah, one of the Wilsons. But he says, oh, I just came from the OR.
These are OR scrubs.
And he goes,
oh, are they?
Yeah. That's like, it's so
perfect.
Pissy and funny. Like, because he's just being such a shit. But it's just so perfect. And every single time I hear that, I find it hilarious.
And at the sort of climax of the movie, I believe Jason Schwartzman's character, Max, like makes a decision to not try to pursue his interference of the relationship between Bloom and Rosemary anymore.
Mm-hmm.
He sort of decides to sort of back off there. And it's a, I don't know, coming of age moment or a growth moment for that prepubescent character at the very least.
Yeah.
The thing that always struck me about Rushmore is how much Jason Schwartzman did not look like a 15-year-old.
But how old was he when it was made?
I honestly don't know. How old is Jason Schwartzman? Let's find out.
Jason Schwartzman, he is currently 43 years old.
1980 is when he was born. So this movie comes out in 98. So it would have been like 97 when it's being filmed. So he's 17, 18. So not that far off.
Yeah.
He just looks so much older than the kids they have playing next to him.
Yeah, that's true.
And his, you know, trademark birthmark or whatever you want to call it on his face struck me at the time as being fake.
Oh, like a beauty mark?
I thought it wasn't real. Yeah, I thought it was a fake one. I was like, oh, that's a weird aesthetic choice. Huh. Do you like Rushmore? We should give verdicts on these things.
Yeah, I like Rushmore. I like it. It's a gooder.
It seems to have some pathos to it. He hasn't fallen into his sort of intentional palettes yet that he really leans into later on, which, you know, you can like or dislike that about this.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this is where we see the nascent Andersonian-ness
begin.
2001, The Royal Tenenbaums. This is sort of
the penultimate.
I want to say, the zeitgeist of Wes Anderson. Yeah. Not zeitgeist isn't the right term, but this is where the public becomes aware, I think, really, of Wes Anderson's existence, or at least our generation did.
I think so, yeah.
It was my first Wes Anderson film, for sure.
Yeah, I think it was mine, too. And then I watched Rushmore and Bottle Rocket after.
Yeah. And, like, I still feel like Ben Stiller every time I put on an Adidas tracksuit. Royal Tenenbaums is named for the Gene Hackman character, who is the who is the patriarch of the Tenenbaum family, but he is a estranged patriarch. He's no longer sort of with the family, and we get to sort of look at the family's pathos and weirdness and then sort of warmth and charm that finds its way in between the cracks of their, you know, strained relationships.
Mm-hmm.
I find Royal Tenenbaum's heartwarming toward the end, I guess.
Yeah,
I mean, it's too. Very weird, of course.
But it's like a redemption story.
Yes, for Royal, absolutely.
For Royal, yeah. And well, like an acceptance that your family, especially your parents, are not perfect.
Mm.
And that people are not any one thing. And that we're all kind of like marked by trauma in our own way.
Right. So this is interesting, especially for our generation. We're probably, you know, one of the first to sort of grapple with the responsibilities of the previous generation in a very serious way. And how much is supposed to be swept under the rug and forgiven. And where the, the acceptance or the ability to sever those ties and not to feel responsibility to maintain unhealthy relationships with people who treated you poorly.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I just find that interesting because this is very much about a type of reconciliation, but not necessarily a reintegration of Royal into their lives.
Yes. I think that's a really important thing to point out, that like at no point, like they kind of welcome him back, but in a very like boundary rich way.
At a distance. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Boundaries are like, you are not the thing that you thought you are. It is dealing with a narcissistic parent, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Which is sort of the thing that we've all become aware of as we get older in our millennial generation. But
yeah.
And he has to accept that. He has to accept being seen as they see him and having a relationship with them on those terms, as opposed to forcing people to, you know, reflect what he wants to be seen as. This is also my introduction to the brilliance of Angelica Houston.
Oh, she's a powerhouse.
Yeah. I mean, and we'll have to do a ranking on best films for the recurring actors here. But this is, God, this is hard for me for Owen Wilson specifically. Like, Luke Wilson, absolutely my favorite Luke Wilson role in all of this, I think.
Agreed.
And probably his meatiest role. But Owen Wilson as this not actually a member of the family, is just so fucking funny to me, and also sad and heartwarming at the same time. But like,
yeah,
I think it's Ben Stiller who's like, "You're sending my mom your newspaper clippings," and she's like,
"Yeah,
it's nice. He's, you know, he wants to be cared about."
Well, it's so funny that, like, I think we all have that friend growing up, or were that friend where you're like, I just wish that I was a part of that family. Absolutely. Because I really like the energy that they give mm-hmm. off, or they had something really special about them, or you were that family and you were like, who's this guy?
Yeah, this dude's always here. It's definitely the other way for me, constantly in search of another family to fit in with.
My parents, I was a latchkey kid. And so basically anyone that had a mom that was there after school, I was like, oh, just, I'm going to come over too, see what these fresh baked cookies are all about.
Yeah, I'll have dinner. Yeah. Yeah, that's wild.
I just love the use of the name Mordecai, because there's a bird.
Is the falcon named Mordecai?
The falcon is named Mordecai, and it has stuck with me.
So I don't know if we gave enough of a plot here, but basically the royal issue is, like, he's trying to repair his family, get it back, because he finds out he's dying. Or he doesn't, actually.
He uses it as the excuse to get back with the family. He's not actually dying.
Right, he pretends he's dying. He just wants his family back because he feels like he's owed them. Like, they belong to him. They were once a sort of successful public family that has since sort of frayed or worn, or however you want it, perpetually trapped in the 70s aesthetic that the movie is trapped in as well.
Even like Gwyneth Paltrow's character, Margot, as a child, she wears this dark eyeliner. And as an adult, she wears the exact same clothes that she did as like a prepubescent teenager.
Yeah. And same with Luke Wilson's character, who is also basically just, what did we call that? Not failure to launch, the other one, like, frozen development, development.
Development. There you go.
Somebody should make a show called Frozen Development.
TV show.
And yeah, you are made to empathize with some very unlikable characters, which might be one of the things that I enjoy about Wes Anderson films.
So Eli and Margot, played by Luke Wilson and Gwyneth Paltrow, they're siblings who fall in love and have like kind of a romantic moment, but.
And this is far before, you know, we got our Lannisters. So.
Yes. But it's really clear because there's a joke ongoing that Margot is adopted, and Royal reminds her of that every chance he gets. This is my adopted daughter, Margot.
Yes.
It's creepy, but it's not incestuous really, but it is.
On paper, if not genetically.
Yeah. On paper, it's incest. Genetically, no, but still icky.
I have not had any occasion to look into these rules as they apply to New York City whenever this movie is set. And then when he finally does reconnect and drop all his pretense, he finds his way back into some, like we talked about, semblance of his family, Royal Tenenbaum, and then...
Spoilers!
Spoilers for a movie from 2001. What does he get hit by a bus? I forget.
He has a heart attack and he finally dies.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah.
My brain, I think, filled in the blanks because he's riding on the back of like the garbage truck with his grandsons. It makes me feel like he got hit by a car or something.
He basically rekindles. He comes back into the fold after lying to all of them, and he accepts that he's not going to be a part of their lives the way that he wants to be a part of their lives. And then slowly starts to rebuild some semblance of a relationship with some of his family. And then later on, he passes away with his family kind of around him.
Right. Which is, I guess, the greatest redemption that character could hope for.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Well, let's move it along. Do we like the Royal Tenenbaums?
Oh, we love it.
Yeah. I mean, it is sort of seminal, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the one that sort of cements the large millennial love for the Wes Anderson films.
The Wes Andersons, yep.
We're moving on. 2004, The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
Who I would argue, this is the greatest soundtrack of all the Wes Andersons.
Oh, it's so...
so good.
So it's a bunch of... fucking my stupid aspartame brain. What is his name? Starman. Why can I not remember one of the most influential musicians of my entire life? The guy who taught me that it was okay to eschew the traditional roles of masculinity, who was the Goblin King.
What?
And I can't remember his real name.
David Bowie.
Thank you.
Oh,
fuck.
My God.
The entire soundtrack is David Bowie covers.
Yes.
By a Portuguese guitarist.
There we go. There we go.
Pele dos Santos. That's it.
It's so...
And it's fantastic.
Like, this is absolutely amazing. everything about the soundtrack is just so spot on. Like the kind of like techno-y beats to the David Bowie covers, like it's incredible.
Yeah, and this movie is sort of given to us. We get further into that storybook aesthetic that this movie is basically done as like cutaways. We get these beautiful cutaway scenes where we just get to go into this clearly fake, like, you know, he's not trying to provide realism in his film here. Like we have set pieces that are just hilariously cutaway. I mean, it's hard to pick a favorite Willem Dafoe role, but this might be it.
Oh.
It's probably a favorite Bill Murray. It's probably my favorite Owen Wilson as well. Angelica Houston's as good as always, but she's got less to do in this one, I think, than others. And then we get our Jeff Goldblum in this as well. Like, it's just...
And some Cate Blanchett.
Yeah, yeah. As the nosy reporter honing in on things. And this is just a movie about being lonely. I guess a lot of them are.
Well, lonely, but also, like, aging.
Mm-hmm.
And not being what you thought it was going to be to get old.
I always get latched onto the relationship between Owen Wilson's character and Bill Murray's characters.
And so what's the plot of the movie?
So Steve Zissou, The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, follows our character Bill Murray as the main dude, Steve Zissou, who's working on a latest documentary at sea.
And he's like a Jacques Cousteau-esque type person.
Yeah, he is very clearly ripped off of Jacques Cousteau. And his partner, Esteban, is murdered by a creature that people are not have a hard time believing actually exists. It's like this 10-whatever-meter-long, luminescently spotted creature that Zissou describes as a jaguar shark, which just doesn't exist. The whole thing becomes an issue. He gets laughed out of like the Explorer Society or whatever the fuck it is.
Yeah.
Bunch of rich dudes sitting around in a hall with their portraits smoking cigars.
Mm-hmm.
And so his latest documentary is an attempt to find that creature and prove himself. And, you know, and all the while he has a interloping reporter come to sort of do a story on him, and also a finger quotes long lost son who shows up.
Yes.
And at the same time, his wife is sort of estranged from him, and their relationship has gone off the rails. They're still cordial and friendly, but they have grown apart, and he's just sort of alone at the same time around all of his sort of fame deteriorating. It is definitely, like you said, a bent to, you know, the dissolution of everything, the death of everything.
Just like the
nihilism in a way.
Well, like his fame has faded. He used to be this really exciting person, and now people just think that he's like a laughing stock.
A joke.
Like people don't think that he's serious anymore. And he has nothing to grasp onto, but he has this moment at the end again, whatever, spoiler alert.
Spoilers.
They find the creature, and there isn't film, but they're all together, and they see that.
It's magical. Oh, it's a magical moment. They're all crowded into that screen and staring at this thing, and they know. They don't need to prove it to anybody else anymore. And they come together in a friendship and a relationship. And that's the thing I like about Owen Wilson and Bill Murray's character's relationship, is that towards the end, it becomes very clear that neither of them actually need verification of the paternity.
But the paternity comes back and he's not his father.
Yeah, but he has become
but
that
it didn't
to
matter.
Him. Yeah, they have become this this thing that each other needed.
Yeah.
One of them needed to find a hero. One of them needed to be a hero to somebody. And they got to be that.
And can I just say, the best costume.
Oh, so good.
Ever. Like if so good. Their little red caps.
Maybe, I'm just going to throw this out there. This might be where the millennial beanie takes hold.
No.
We have been described as the beanie generation.
The
toque generation.
I don't like the word beanie. I like toque. I'm fine with that.
I know. We're Canadians. Beanie? We fucking hate beanie. But I am now thinking about this little skit that Jimmy Fallon and Ant-Man do.
Paul Rudd.
I am so bad at instant recall. Paul Rudd and Jimmy Fallon do this little song that I just became aware of called Teeny Weeny Beanie.
It's a cold, cold day and I'm getting the chills. Wanna make them go away, I need something for reals. Whether I'm in my house or out on the street, I want a hat right now that can bring me the heat. It's a teeny weeny beanie. It's a teeny weeny beanie. It don't cover your ears cause you still need to hear. It's a teeny weeny beanie. Wear a teeny weeny beanie while I'm singing to Jolene.
Jolene, 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 Jolene. I'm begging of you, please don't take my
teeny weeny beanie.
It's a teeny weeny beanie. It's a teeny weeny beanie. It's made out of wool and it makes you look cool. It's a teeny weeny beanie.
And all I can think during this entire thing is just like, huh, this aesthetic does it for me. Like, I would dress like this.
To me, it just looks like the scenester bicycle person who's always like riding their bike somewhere with their pant leg rolled up.
Yeah, yeah. So it doesn't get caught in the chain. I just saw this. So that's why beanie is fresh on my mind.
That's good.
We need to take a little break, a little halftime. Are we done with Steve Zissou? Are we?
We're done, but we got to start cranking these through, Ben. There's still like 14 left.
Okay. There's only 11 total movies.
Well, there's like, but they're
growing through three. Da-na-na-na-na, it's Bill Murray. Da-na-na-na-na.
Yay.
Listeners, did you guess Bill Murray?
Bill Murray's always there in the background somewhere.
Good job.
The second this started, if you're a listener of the show and you know who's that Pokemon, you knew it was going to be Bill Murray.
Well, this is going to be Bill Murray. Yeah, I was going to describe him at his current age with like just droopy skin everywhere.
He looks like that dog.
The way we described Margaret Atwood like 2 years ago.
The sad dog.
Yeah, he looks like Droopy. Droopy the dog.
Okay, what's up next?
Were you expecting someone else?
Bill Murray, how did you get in here?
All right, we go to, that was 2004, Life Aquatic. Yep. I love Life Aquatic. It was
so good.
The final word is it's one of the least critically acclaimed movies and the biggest flop financially.
Which is shocking.
I guess when you go off of Royal Tenenbaums, people began to expect a certain something from that. And they got a similar aesthetically, but very different tonally movie.
Yeah.
Or not different enough. I don't know what the fuck people's problem is. Let's go. 2007.
Yeah.
The Darjeeling Limited. So this is a somewhat controversial one.
Yes.
But the plot is basically three brothers, Adrian Brody, Jason Schwartzman, and Owen Wilson.
Ben Affleck, yeah. Yeah.
There you go. Affleck?
Just throwing out names.
Has Ben Affleck ever been in a Wes Anderson film?
No.
I don't think he'd fit. What if they did a Wes Anderson film where it was Matt Damon and Ben Affleck doing something? It could just be a recreation of like Good Will Hunting.
But like from a Wes Anderson perspective.
Yeah. Anyhow, let's keep going. Those three brothers, the actors that I mentioned, they meet up on a train in India in order to reconnect a year after their father's funeral. And surreptitiously on the part of Owen Wilson's character to look for their missing mother.
Yes.
Who has been gone for many years and they have not heard from or seen. She didn't come to their father's funeral either. And they need to deal with some emotional stuff.
Yeah. You know, I would argue that aesthetically, this is one of his strongest movies.
Oh, it's beautiful.
But that there's also, I think, some of the strongest acting performances out of Owen Wilson to date.
Absolutely. All three of them bring really great performances here.
Knowing Owen Wilson's work, I think it's one of his best. And then there's a couple of moments with Angelica Houston that are like amazing.
Oh, this is the movie that I would put as Angelica Houston's like best part in this. And she's not in it like
for very long. No, she's in it for like 10, 15 minutes.
She is an important character for a scene. But yeah, she is fantastic in this. This was like, oh, Morticia Adams is amazing.
Yeah. There's the line where, okay, so they get on the train. It's a journey filled with peril. They get into fights. They get into brotherly arguments. One of them has sex with one of the attendants.
They just cause havoc in the lives of other people. And they are, you know, your traditional American tourists who are there for their own purposes and don't give a shit about what's going on around them. And I think that's intentional, personally. But we can get into some criticisms of Wes Anderson's sort of, you know, choices later on. But yeah, Darjeeling Limited is, to me, yeah, absolutely beautiful film.
It's beautiful. There's when they eventually do find their mother, Angelica Houston's character, and they're talking about like, well, why weren't you there for us? And she stops and says like, who are you talking to? And looks behind her and says, are you're not talking to me. Are you talking to her? And I thought like, that was like, it was so cruel. But at the same time too, it was this moment of like, the person that you're mad at doesn't exist anymore.
If they ever did.
What are you doing here?
I live here. These people need me.
What about us?
You're talking to her. You're talking to someone else. You're not talking to me. I don't know the answers to these questions, and I don't see myself this way. Listen, I'm sorry we lost her father. We'll never get over it, but it's okay. There are greater forces at work. Yes, the past happened. But it's over, isn't it?
Not for us.
What you expect of me isn't my problem. And I kind of thought like, damn.
You are never going to get what you came here looking for.
Exactly. And that's a cold, hard thing to hear from your parent.
Mm-hmm.
But I also was like, I get that. Weirdly, like it's yeah. hard to hear. But damn, that line, I was like, ooh, that's good.
And the realization that none of the things that they actually said that they were there for were what they yeah. were there for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like none of them are being honest with each other about their reasons for being there. And they are treating the place like a backdrop to their own lives until a certain pivotal moment in the movie where they are forced to engage with the existence of other people and, you know, the existence of different cultures in a very real way.
Yeah.
Without sort of truth. And it's a very beautiful moment, I think.
It's a beautiful movie. It's a hard movie, but it's a beautiful movie.
Yeah. And I don't think like the intentionality necessarily excuses the approach to, you know, the place as a backdrop, but you know, it adds some context to the focus of, you know, these are characters that we're not supposed to like.
Yeah.
They are not likable characters. Even if we enjoy watching them, they're not, you know, that's the wonderful thing to learn about a protagonist doesn't need to be a good person or a nice person or, you know, a positive person. They are simply our point of view and the person whose journey we're following.
Yeah.
I think this movie exemplifies that literary concept. Where do they end? They go home. They maybe have a better relationship with each other and give up on a lot of things that were causing them problems.
Or maybe they don't.
Maybe. Maybe they don't. Maybe they just go back to their old routines. And maybe India isn't the life-changing magical place for everybody that some people want it to be.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just a train ride and you acted like an asshole. Let's go. Let's move. Do we like the Darjeeling Limited? I do.
Yeah, I do too.
And the music is beautiful again. Oh,
gorgeous, yeah.
2009, we get the first animated feature from Wes Anderson. Fantastic Mr. Fox, based off of, it's a Roald Dahl book, right?
Roald Dahl.
Yeah. Who is ostensibly an asshole himself.
But we start to see this affinity that Wes Anderson has with Roald Dahl because then there's the current Netflix series of Roald Dahl short films that are currently out there.
I have not seen that. Is it any good?
They're very Wes Anderson. They're good. Okay. The stories are sad and kind of upsetting, and it just brings it forth. I don't know if you know who Richard Iowati is.
It sounds familiar, but
he's been in a bunch of things, but he's a British comedian and actor. He was in the IT Crowd.
Oh, yeah, I do then.
Yeah, Moss. But he is in a couple of these short films on Netflix, and he's just so perfect. Like, he is made to be in a Wes Anderson movie, and I just love him so much. So if anything, just watch it for Richard Iowati because he's amazing. But anyway, Fantastic Mr. Fox, I have to say, it is my all-time favorite Wes Anderson, if not up there, of favorite movies of all time. I love it so much. I love it. George Clooney as Mr. Fox. Come on.
Are you cussing me?
You just got to not do it, man. That's all.
I understand what you're saying, and your comments are valuable, but I'm going to ignore your advice.
The cuss you are.
The cuss am I? Are you cussing with me?
No, you cussing with me?
Don't cuss and point
at me. You're
going
to cuss with somebody. You're not going to cuss with me, you little cuss.
You're going to cuss with me. Just by the tree.
I like, you've got just like an all-star powerful cast, like the Badger as Bill, like Bill Murray as the Badger. Like, oh, it's so good.
Is it Jason Schwartzman as the son?
Yes, where he's got the sock on his head like a balaclava.
You should probably put your bandit hat on now. Personally, I don't have one, but I modified this tube sock.
We look good.
Yeah, we do.
Surprise! It is producer Jess here. Ben's kid ends up having a night terror right about here, and Lexi and Ben end the recording so that Ben can go be a dad. They ended up recording the second half of this episode another day, and they got so much good content that I told them that they should just split this episode into two and have this episode be part one and then come back next time for part two. So, yeah, this is going to be the end of part one. Surprise, abrupt surprise ending that I am bringing us out on. I can't remember what else Lexi and Ben usually say here, which is dumb because I've listened to almost 80 of these episodes. I think they say, thank you for listening. Send them hate mail. They usually say, please send us hate emails. They love hate emails. And see you next time. And then they go, dork, 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 dork.
Thanks for listening to Dork Matters. If you like the podcast, subscribe, give us a rating, and tell your friends about us.
If you are a fellow dork and have a dork issue that you think we need to discuss, tell us on our social media. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter. You can also check out original art and other content from Ben and myself.
We'd like to say a big thank you to Yabra for the use of our theme song, Dance, off of their Astral EP, as well as a thank you to Jess Schmidt for producing and editing our podcast. Thanks, Jess.
Dork Matters.
This podcast is created on the traditional territories of the Blackfoot Nations, which includes the Siksika, the Piikani, and the Kainai. We also acknowledge the Stoney Nakoda Nation, Sutena, and Métis Nation, Region 3.